Outrider, someone who rides in front of or alongside a procession as an escort, a lookout, a vanguard. The Outrider is separate from, but in communication with, the mainstream, pushing the boundaries, exploring, and reporting back from the frontier. Welcome to the Outrider Podcast, an ongoing conversation from the fringes of the mainstream. Recording. Here we are for our July episode of the Outrider Podcast. Hi, I'm Jason.
Hi, I'm Jen.
What are you drinking this time?
I'm doing the same IPA that I often do.
Ah.
I wasn't going to drink today because I'm doing a mostly moist June
right
this month, but I was like, I'm recording a podcast. I've got to have a beer.
Yeah.
Or two, or at most two.
Yeah, I've been trying to cut back on my drinking, but I've been doing a pretty good job. But as you can see today, I'm not drinking the whole box. I'm being reasonable.
No, I wouldn't think so. Listeners, he just showed me a giant black box of wine. Actually, I like that kind of wine. That's a good label. I'm doing Upslope IPA.
I got a bit of advice from my therapist. You know, we were talking about, you know, drinking at one point, and we brought up, you know, the expense and all the bottles like this. And my therapist, I think you suggested that I switch to boxed wine because it would be more economical.
Wow. What a good therapist.
Well, you know,
she's
that's like
for more wine, cheaper.
Right. So like this is like cheaper. $20 and it basically equals four bottles.
Yeah.
It's just wanting to have one glass and not have an open bottle around for 2 days.
True. Or like you feel like you have to finish the bottle because you opened it.
Which has been a problem of mine since the pandemic.
Yeah, that's happened to me so many times.
Well, I opened that's it. Why the box I is already good. Drank half of it, and it's only 9:30. Might as well finish it off.
I might as well. Instead of...
Don't have anything to do. Don't have anywhere to go.
Hey.
Yep.
No one to do, nothing to see.
Yeah. All right, so what are you reading and working on?
I finished The Quit book by Annie Duke. Did I tell you about that one last time? I don't remember.
I don't remember either. I was short on show notes last time.
Oh, shit. Well, I finished Quit by Annie Duke, and it's all about the sort of toxic hustle culture that's in America. And about how actually quitting is sort of a good thing sometimes. So how about chill the fuck out?
I have that on my shelf. I haven't finished it yet.
It's great.
I haven't started.
So I did that. You're pre-quit. You can get pregnant from pre-quit. Just be careful with that shit. So that, and I just finished a quarter of DU. The quarter was a... what the hell was I teaching? Oh, the writing workshop, the writer's workshop. And I had a bunch of crafty books. And now I just this last week was the first week of my new DU quarter. And that is a fiction writing course. Both of those are for grad students. So I'm reading through my required chapters of Burroughs Writing Fiction, which is the required book for this class that I'm currently doing. So I think it was on my eternally long list of craft books that you were asking for last time. But this is really good. This is really well set up. And it's good. and I'm writing a couple of Substacks that are excellent. The one that's a couple that really stand out are Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's Substack. He's just such a good writer.
Yep.
I hear that, you know, he used to be good at basketball or something. I don't know, but a little good at basketball, maybe. But yeah, no, it just, in all seriousness, he's quite a good writer, and it's great reading his work. And I'm having a great time with this historical Substack called Dirtbags to the Ages. And she's yep. just so witty and so funny. She has a really good balance between the research and just such funny puns and jokes as she goes. It's like, it's a really well done balance. It's not too jokey and it's not too dry. It's like a perfect balance of the two things. So that's basically what I'm reading. What else am I reading? Oh yeah, I'm about to start my Michel Foucault journey, but I have not started that yet. I'll let you know how that goes. Yeah. I have a prescription of how I'm supposed to tackle him. So I'm reading a capitalism book, and I'll tell you about that next after I finish it. So after I finish that, then I'll start my Foucault journey. What are you reading?
Well.
Oh, and I got your book that you sent me in the mail. Not your book, but the book that you sent me.
Right. This book is not for you.
It looks great.
By Daniel Hoyt. I had an extra copy laying around because apparently I bought it twice.
You do that. You do that, don't you?
No, it's been the first time I've done it in a while. I mean, I do buy multiple copies of some books, but usually consciously and on purpose, thinking, oh, I'll give this to someone because I really like it.
Right, right.
I hadn't read Dan's book yet. I bought one copy of, like, when it came out, and it was on my to-be-read shelf and got buried or whatever. And then he came down to do a reading, and I went to go see the reading because I like to support particularly writers, you know, from the local and the region, whatever. He's teaches at mm-hmm. K-State and things like that. So I popped in there, and while I listened to him read and whatever, and bought a copy of the book and got home. It was like, I'll put this on the shelf in alphabetical order because I redid all the shelves and shit.
Oh,
it was already there. So
did you get to sign it?
Yeah, I kept the signed one. You got the unsigned
nice.
One. Anyway, so I'm still reading. I've kind of been sidetracked, but I'm still reading Gavin's book, Notes from the Coming War.
Nice. Okay.
I had to put that aside because, and I'll get to this a little bit when we talk about what I'm writing, but I was working on my new project one day, and I was sitting there thinking on it, and I don't know what thought led to the thought, but suddenly I realized, fuck, I think I actually have to finish reading Don Quixote.
Oh.
I've been wandering around in Don Quixote for 20 years and never finishing it.
You've been fighting a windmill here and there.
Well, you know, I get a little distracted or something. It's just, I don't know if I want to do this or not.
That's a classic and a doorstop, though. That's a pretty, that's a hefty
right
sort of thing.
So I've started kind of reading that, but I figured what I would do before I actually dug into reading Don Quixote. And I have the Smollett translation from years and years ago.
Oh, okay. Right? Yeah, that's a good one.
But I was looking for a newer, potentially better translation and stumbled across this one by James Montgomery, which got a lot of reviews and was, but is on a very small press. So I got that. That's the one I'm eventually going to be reading.
Oh, that's great.
But I got a couple of books about Don Quixote so that I could kind of not have to wade through Quixote and then think, whoa, how does that apply to the thought that I had that about my new book that made me think I needed to read Quixote finally. So I've been reading the novel and Quixote, The Novel and the World by Ilan Stevens.
Oh, cool.
Which is very fascinating because it is kind of preparing me for what I'm going to read in Quixote, but also helping me frame, you know, what is El Quixote about? Sorry, I've gotten into calling it that because that's what he calls it throughout this book is El Quijote, which is a thing that the Spanish-speaking world calls Don Quixote rather than the the Quixote. Like, you know, like
it's like it's like the Japanese calling the mountain Fuji-san.
And it turns out that there's a lot of stuff that my brain was way ahead of my consciousness. My subconscious was way ahead of my consciousness.
Oh, and interesting.
And there is a lot going on in Don Quixote that does figure into what I'm trying to do with this new book.
Cool.
Now, I'm not trying to retell Don Quixote for, like, you know, 21st century America, but I realize that there are going to be a lot of thematic and, in some cases, narrative echoes.
Cool.
So reading Quixote then becomes important to make sure that I'm actually doing something that's not an unconscious copying.
Right. You're not. Right? You're doing it right. Yeah, right.
Or that I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel, making a decision about the story, thinking I'm being wildly original, and then somebody goes, you know, they did that in Don Quixote, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So you can be conscious about your inspiration.
How to echo, and because I'm wrestling with the same ideas, which means if I'm aware and conscious, I'm wrestling with Quixote. So I should be fully aware of Quixote as opposed to the partially aware of Quixote that I've been because I've never finished the damn book.
Right. You should be like, yeah. It should be on purpose that you're doing this instead of accidentally. Yeah, for sure. Well, that sounds cool.
Which, you know, we'll get into the craft discussion we're going to have in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am the master of the segue.
What's the new thing that you're writing?
Right now, the working title is called Crazy Unconscious Days.
Cool.
Which I don't know if you were ever subjected to my drunken telling of the Crazy Unconscious Days with me and the donkey named Jorge and the monkey named Steve when we were smuggling piñatas across the border into Tijuana.
I did. I've heard you talk about this before. Oh, I love it.
So, yeah.
So this is just a fresh thing then. Oh, that's great.
Well, you know, I think I started, you know, telling these little drunken on the spot, on the fly stories, you know, my crazy unconscious days in Tijuana with Jorge the donkey and Steve the monkey and our illicit,
Jorge.
Smuggling of piñatas across the border.
That's right.
So I started that as an undergrad, just, you know, as kind of a fun, you know, and I kind of always was thinking I should do something with that, turn it into a thing.
Yeah, it could almost be like a Kerouacian kind of journey.
Kind
sort of.
Of
thing.
Yeah. You know, I started trying to turn it into a screenplay, and that wasn't really working because I think trying to write a screenplay and also at the same time getting comfortable with the screenplay format was causing a block. So I sat around and tried to figure out, well, how do I write this as a screenplay without actually writing the screenplay and then just worry about the formatting later?
Oh, right.
And I've tried writing screenplays before and not succeeded, and trying to refresh my memory on kind of like, well, how did, you know, what do you need to do? Because I took Junior Burke's class on screenplay when we were at Naropa.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I never got to do that.
Of course, the whole Sid Field thing and the stuff that's come along, particularly in the post-Star Wars era of Hollywood, everything gets rammed into the Campbell's hero's journey.
It does.
Right. And so basically, because everything gets rammed into that, the pre-draft outline has become like this thing everybody tells you you have to do. You have to plan out your scenes and your sequence and your beats and stuff like this. And it's like, I have never done that with anything I've written. And for a while, I was trying to force myself into that and do the outlining, and it didn't work. I just lost interest because I basically was telling the story before I tried to write it, which immediately...
You're sort of morally against doing that as far as I understand, right?
I don't know about morally, but I like to explore. I like to investigate, right? And if I tell the story before I tell the story, why the fuck do I need to tell the story again?
Right.
So I couldn't figure out a good way to get around that notion of needing to tell the story before I tell the story that was bogging me down with screenplays thing. Yeah. So I said, fuck it. I'll just write a goddamn novel because that's what I do. And
because that's what, yeah,
that's what I do.
Comfort zone ahoy.
And then fine, I'll go back and use the novel. The novel will be my outline and I'll just pull it apart and make a screenplay out of that.
Yeah, you can just get it adapted by yourself. Oh, how fun.
So yeah, I've started working on that.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
You know, so there's a lot of mirroring and duality and stuff like that going on in the story.
Same thing in Poison Moon. There's a lot of mirroring and duality going on there.
Yeah, but not as blatant, not as obvious, not quite in the way. Because yeah, the idea of a doppelganger seems to be in my brain a lot lately. So apparently I'm going through my novel doppelganger phase.
Well, and there's some things that you do at the end of the sample too that are very like sort of paralleling and stuff like that. But we'll get into that.
Between the two characters, right. So yeah, but no, this one is more of a existential mirror.
Yeah, that sounds really fun.
Because when I have sat down to start the novel, my focusing element was this epigraph that I was stealing from Joseph Campbell, which is, you must be willing to give up the life you planned in order to have the life that is waiting for you. So right. that's the lead epigraph on the manuscript. And then right below it, I have my own epigraph that I wrote that says, yeah, but what if the life that's waiting for me is the life in a cubicle farm making some other asshole rich?
That's right. That's right.
So it's this idea that, you know, and of course, you know, that thing from Campbell about, you know, that giving up the life you plan to have the life that's waiting for you, that's tied into his understanding of the Grail mythology and to that broader concept that Campbell has about follow your bliss.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Which is not just do whatever makes you happy.
No, it's a little deeper than that.
It's deeper, more complex, and involves a lot more sacrifice than just, you know, like going off in the corner to jerk off and now I'm happy.
Yeah, people take a lot of his stuff out of context.
Right. And follow your bliss is often taken out of context in a very selfish, you know, kind of...
There's like self-help books written about it. And
not really into like... Following your bliss also means sacrifice and struggle and pain and things that aren't happy.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, this piece sounds like it's pretty joyful, actually.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know me. I go dark.
I do know you.
I go very dark.
It's true. It's true. Well, I am still shipping out my memoir. I got a lovely rejection letter from Alien Buddha Press, who wanted to see more of my stuff. They're a tiny, tiny press. And so it literally was just the fact that it was too long. And so they asked me for more stuff that's shorter. So I sent them some of my fiction. So I'm still waiting to hear from them.
Right on.
Which is sweet. And then I'm just kind of still shopping my memoir around.
Yep.
Everyone who's gotten back to me has been very positive about it, but have not gotten it snapped up yet. And my Substack is still going pretty strong. I've gotten a lot of original stuff put up there now. I'm sort of phasing out the oldies and goodies and I'm starting to get a lot of original stuff going on.
Right on. Yeah. So, this is the summer of Jason learning to be incredibly patient.
Ah, yes. Holy shit.
Because I've been sending out...
I think you might open a rift in the space-time continuum. You know how to be patient.
Because I've been keeping to my promise to myself to make at least two, to submit the manuscript for The Poison Moon at least twice a month. So I did two or three in January, one in February, and that's why I said, no, we need to do this twice a month. So then in March, April, May, and June, I've done two. So now I've got, I think actually it figures, it should technically be an even number, but it's more of an odd number. I have, think I have 13 out, or I've made 13 submissions.
Ooh.
Two rejections, and the rest are still like in progress.
Oh.
It's driving me nuts.
Oh, I've gotten ghosted for so many of my, are you sending it to publishers or to agents?
Publishers. Yeah. I've kind of given up on agents on trying to, because
they just ghost you. They just like, don't even respond.
Most of them do. And plus I cannot fucking stand the comp title requirement that agents demand.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We talked about that
and
before.
It drives me batty because it's like, one of the reasons that I write, there are lots of reasons why I write. It's just this weird compulsion, yada, yada, yada. Part of the reason that I write is that I can't find on the bookshelves the story that I really, really want to read. So I'm writing it myself.
So you're doing it yourself. Yeah.
I find a few things that are interesting that I pick up. I put on my to-be-read shelf as my insurance against death, because the more unread books you have, the longer you'll live, because you need to read them all before you die.
You gotta read them. Your TBR shelf is huge, too.
Fuck,
man.
Yeah.
You live to be like 250 years old.
At least another good 50 years out of me, at least. Jesus Christ.
Very least.
And I haven't even had a chance to start that family I wanted.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
So, yeah. So, they always say with the comp titles, Jane Friedman, she's an agent. She's got a blog where some other agents started. She has a post on that blog. I could probably send you a link to it, where she has three or four different agents talk about their guidelines for finding comp titles.
Yeah.
And nobody has the same guidelines, and
no,
they don't.
No,
and,
exactly.
And those guidelines for picking comp titles, they don't put those on their site. They just say three comp titles. And so one woman says, yeah, "Oh, it could be anything, you know, that's, you know, within the last decade or so," and doesn't make a big deal about it being, having been a movie, if it was made into a movie, just, you know, whatever. And another one's like, well, 3 years, and it's okay if it's been made into a movie and is a bestseller, but not so much of a bestseller or runaway hit that it's ubiquitous and everywhere. And it's okay to reference movies or TV shows. It's like, you're talking about genre books, right? You're talking about the subgenre stuff, not literary fiction, when you say
comping
movies and TV shows and shit like that. And then there's one agent who says it can only be in the last 2 years. It can't be too famous, can't be too obscure, can't have been made into a movie or a TV show. It's like,
well, then why would I even like bring it up?
One woman's like, you know, it needs to be the perfect comp, because no comp is better than a sort of comp. It's like the perfect comp.
That doesn't make any sense.
That doesn't make any fucking sense. And then there was another, here's how I find comp titles. And it's got all this like searching keywords on the Library of Congress and seeing what's like next to you on the bookshelf and all this other shit. And I start trying to follow these guidelines to find comp titles.
It's nonsense.
For The Poison Moon that we're going to talk about here in a moment. And I can't find shit.
That's nonsense.
I can't find anything. So, I type in a keyword like doppelgangers, and it's all science fiction.
Right.
I type in exotic dancers, and it's all like porn or ethnographic studies of sex workers, but no novels. Or if it is a novel, it's a detective story or a crime novel. Right.
Male loneliness, and then you have like,
you know, or you type in things about, you like, you know, masculinity or male friendship, and again, not novels. Or if it did pop up with a novel, it was a science fiction novel. And none of these are appropriate comps for literary fiction.
No, no.
I can't find shit. The only comp titles I can come up with are the three that I often mention as being the novels that I had in mind and accessed while I was writing this one to kind of help me figure out what I wanted to do.
Ones that you're literally inspired by.
Right. So The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Well, that's too old and too famous, and it was made into a movie.
Just ignore all the requirements.
That doesn't work as a comp title. And then you have So Long, See You Tomorrow by William Maxwell. That's too old and too obscure. And then the most recent one, Lindsay Drager's The Archive of Alternate Endings. Well, that was in 2019. So that's now like 4 years old. So that's beyond the 2 to 3 years that the other agents were talking about. I've got one comp that's in the window where they would be.
I just think
like,
that you should use those anyway. Fuck it. You know?
Yeah, I'd not even try, considering that because I've just in the last 14 years, I've just gotten nothing from agents, no matter what. Yeah, so it's like the only way to get my stuff out there is to find that small press that's willing to do what Unbridled did for me back then, which is this unknown, untested writer whose work they like and it resonates with them, and they're going to try and support that writer. That's my route.
That's
the case.
Speaking of, I've got two poems published recently, but anyway.
Oh,
one
you
of
did.
Them was in Tarte.
I think I saw
press,
one of them
in their spring showcase, and the other one was at South Broadway Ghost Society, South Broadway Press. Two of my gnarliest poems. I'm like, do you people just like my gnarly shit? That's cool. I think South Broadway wants to do my postmodernism definition. I think you've read that like way back when I first wrote it, and I've adapted it since. But anyway,
oh maybe.
But let's talk about Poison Moon, or the sample thereof.
Right, the sample. So, for our audience, in the show notes there'll be a link to my website where you can access a sample that we'll be talking about here today. Because we're going to be talking about form and function, or just form.
How does form
function?
Function.
How does form function? Or how does the function of a novel?
I think what we wanted to talk about, at least this is my understanding, is how the form of this piece adds to its function. Like what is it trying to do, and does the form of it? How does the form of it do that?
So kind of on a broad scheme, I get really, especially these days, I get really bored with traditionally structured
of any genre
novels. Of just about any genre, yeah. Because it feels like I can tell what's coming next. Maybe not on a point-by-point line with a plot, like, oh, this character's going to do this, this character's going to do that. But I know kind of how the story is going to develop. Here's where we're going to have a chapter that will kind of warm me up to this character. Here's a chapter that'll be the conflict.
Yeah, it's funny.
Here's the
thing. So my partner is practicing guitar a lot. He's really good at it already, but he's practicing it like in a more refined way, in a more music theory kind of way. And he's training his ear quite a bit because of that. And my younger stepgoblin is also learning guitar. He's learning how to train his ear. And that's something that my Paul was saying too. He's just like, yeah, I'm like, I never heard this song before, but I'm playing it because I can hear this chord and I can pretty much get what kind of a song this is. And I can pretty much understand that this next chord is going to be what's coming up. So that's why I can play this song without having heard it, is that I can basically predict the chord progression just based on all of my prior knowledge of it. So that's kind of how you're feeling about lots of fiction, is just like, I can just tell what the next chord's going to be. Like I can just.
Right. And I was having a conversation about this with a friend of mine last week who really took it upon herself to be like, are you sure about that? You can really do that. And kind of tested me on it.
Oh, really?
I don't know how well I passed in her estimation. And plus, I didn't want to get too much into it because I always feel like I'm, I actually talked to my therapist about this. I feel like oftentimes that I alienate friends around here by going off on these, you know, tangents about, you know, literary aesthetics and my whatever.
The only person I feel safe doing that
with is you.
Yes.
For example, this is a little anecdote. I was in the bookstore a couple of weeks ago doing my usual walk through the fiction section and picking up various books and reading the first paragraph or so and the author's bio and all that stuff like that to decide if it was something I wanted to put on my to-be-read shelf for the end of the world. And I came across this book that the cover was just festooned with praise from all sorts of, you know, famous and, you know, well-sold, well-reviewed writers
these days
now,
too, to put, like, just all glowing of that on the cover.
And it's on the back and it's on the cover and there's like, you know, the end pages are loaded with these people. Oh, this is a great new voice and the thing and the whatever. And, oh, he's so fantastic. All right, so I pick it up. I read the dust jacket
synopsis.
Copy, you know, that tells me about what the story is. I'm like, okay, whatever. I flip to the first page.
Let me guess, the house was entirely uninhabited upstairs too, no?
No. But I flip to the first page and start reading, and it seems to be okay. It's first person. It manages to avoid the world funnel, which is...
Yeah, explain.
Okay, so the world funnel is this idea I've come up with where a writer says in the first paragraph of a first-person novel, think of the intro to The Great Gatsby. It's like, you know, where it starts off with Nick relaying the advice his father gave him about being open to the world and whatever. And then it begins to narrow down to the specific moment when he starts his story, that kind of initiating moment when he goes and moves to West Egg.
I see.
And that's kind of the world funnel. It's like, my mother told me that all people pick their nose with their left pinky. And that's just one thing that I learned was true and yada, yada. And then one day I was walking down the street one summer, like I always did that summer. And then the dog picked my nose with its tail. Right. And that's where the story starts. Right. That's the world funnel. It's giving you some broad philosophical statement about how the world is and who told it to me. And this how and that narrows down
it's
to
like
the
having an introduction
instigating
to an
moment
essay
of the story.
Before you get to the thesis, sort of.
Right. And usually it's a sentence or two, a paragraph. Well, this guy, he manages to, avoid
That's
the
cool.
whole world funnel thing. But it's still, it's first person, you know, young person, not quite of age. I kind of like going, okay, this is a first person
young
buildings
white man.
Roman. I kind of get it. Whatever.
Okay, good.
But then I flipped back to the author's bio and immediately threw the book back on the shelf. I was like, fuck
why?
That. You
I
know
think
why?
I have three ideas, but tell me which it is. Yeah, that was the one I was
graduated
thinking.
Graduated from the Iowa
thinking.
Writers Workshop.
Shit.
And his personal bio was almost exactly like the fucking blurb for the story description. This was like the most pure example of the first person semi-autobiographical Bildungsroman, the Iowa Writers Workshop formula for the first novel. And I was like, fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck whoever told you to write like this and stop it. Do something different with your life. Fuck you.
And that publisher is so smug and happy because they actually published a black author.
So after that anecdote, what I thought I would bring in.
No.
Because I don't want to use that person's name or that book. Let them have the, whatever the success they're going to get with that book. So what I thought I'd do is at least for a kind of an example of and be able to give someone an actual reference to look at, I thought I would pick on a book that I like.
Oh, okay. Great.
By an author who's dead. So I pulled out William Kennedy's Ironweed. Pulitzer Prize winner. I loved this book when I read it. But this is basically how the typical 20th century mm-hmm. into the 21st century novel starts.
Okay.
This serves as a good template for how that starts. And I'm going to read the first couple sentences. Riding up the winding road of St. Agnes Cemetery in the back of a rattling old truck, Francis Phelan became aware that the dead, even more than the living, settled down in neighborhoods.
Cool.
Now, this is the third person narrative version. Really good sentence. Mm-hmm. But this is the third person narrative version of the world mm-hmm. funnel. Because this is a very broad statement about, you know, the world. And on top of that, you get the main character's full name right there in the first mm-hmm. sentence. So you know who exactly you're getting focalized through right off the bat. That's just the first sentence, right? And the truck was suddenly surrounded by fields of monuments and centigraphs of kindred design and striking size, all guarding the privileged dead. Yeah. And then we get more specific into the moment. Francis Phelan's coming home, and that's the beginning.
It's like when you start out with a big wide shot, and you like from bird's eye view, and then you pan in.
It's like those old, 30s and 40s movies where you start off with the view of the globe and then it zooms down into like, you know, Toadsuck, Arkansas and Billy Bob Toadsucker. And that's your story right there taking place in the great wide world.
I want to know what happens to Billy Bob Toadsucker.
Right. And I don't.
Okay. So yes, that definitely makes sense.
Got to refill the wine glass. So anyway, like I said, I've for 20 mm-hmm. years kind of recognized that pattern, and all the stuff that I've read, all the great literature that I've read, all the stuff that I like tends to start that way. And I didn't really want to do that, you know, because it led me into writing a certain way that didn't appeal to me, and that I ended up kind of unconsciously following and mimicking
other people's style.
Well, that's how you start. And I was not terribly good at other people's style. So that when I wrote The Evolution of Shadows, when I've written other projects, one of the things I do, and this is a craft, a form decision, is that I have my ideas that I kind of start with. I have a base story, usually inspired by an image. The shoulder biting in The Evolution of Shadows, you know, the hanged woman in the Palace of Winds, the rusted car in the time capsule crypt with a body inside of it for Far 19. And then the Poison Moon, you know, it's hard to remember what the image was that really started it, because I think I actually had the idea for this story years and years and years ago and didn't quite. Well, I had it.
Well, isn't
back
it
in
the
2013?
Isn't it the bone with the lunar pricks in it, and that leads, and that then that leads.
That may be the rational place in hindsight to pick out the image, because that's kind of the reason behind the structure as well. Why this novel takes the form that it does.
You talk about the moon first, and then its significance to society, and then what's an interesting thing I found is like right after that. You have all of the artifacts from this absent woman scattered around the world, basically. And so we get this image of these pricks in the bone, like a scattering of dots, and then we get her artifacts as sort of an echo of that image.
You know what's funny though? Is that it's actually
a deconstructed world funnel. How is it not a world funnel? Why is it deconstructed?
It's a deconstructed world funnel. The regular world funnel is like that first sentence of Ironweed, where the world and the main character and the story are kind of rolled into one thing.
It's a bigger theory before you get to the specific kind of.
Right. So the world funnel, as it's normally constructed, is it's one sentence or a couple of sentences. You take all of the various components, which is your big thing about the world, a sort of more generalized, more specific thing that's closer to the heart of the story, and then you have the story. And they kind of all roll it into one. So in that one, in that world funnel in Ironweed, you have riding up the winding road of St. Agnes Cemetery. So that's a very specific thing. He's kind of, in one sentence, has reordered the typical order of the world funnel. Because it's very specific. He's actually went mid-range, which is the neighborhood where the cemetery is. Then he goes specific by giving you Francis Phelan and the character's name. So that gets down into the specific of the story and his awareness. And his awareness then is the big balloon statement.
So
about
how
the
is
dead
that,
settling down in neighborhoods, right?
Yes.
So that's a world funnel, and that's combined and compressed into
one
sentence. What I did was I deconstructed the world funnel, because you have your broad thing, which is the Blanchard bone.
Yes.
And that's the broad universal thing. That's the whole world. That's one chapter, one section by itself. Nothing else attached to it. It doesn't mention the main characters or their story or their dilemma. It doesn't give you a setting of anything. That section on the Blanchard bone is just the cosmic broad world statement. Then the next section, which is the artifacts, Celine's artifacts, that's the more focused thing, getting into the universe, the world of the story, to the neighborhood of the story. So you've gone from the world of the Blanchard bone.
Yeah, but the scattering.
And the counting and evolution of time that applies everywhere on the globe. That applies everywhere on the globe. And then you get down to a specific spot on the globe, which is Wichita, where all the artifacts are. The moon applies to everybody. Celine's artifacts only apply to her, no matter where they are in the world. That's her geography.
Yeah.
That's not the world's geography.
Yeah.
The bone is the world geography. Celine's artifacts, that's her geography. They might be scattered. And it talks about that in that narrative, that it's spreading out from her. And her center is Wichita.
Yes,
and then you get into the next section, and that's where the story starts. So I've deconstructed the world funnel. You can now see it. The broad Blanchard bone. That's the evidence of the human creation of time.
Right.
And then you get to Celine's creation of art. And it may be in Amsterdam. It may be in Connecticut. But it's Celine's creation of art.
From a center.
From a specific location that spreads.
Yeah.
And then you get Truman.
Yeah, I can see that.
Part of the reason that I did that, this was a conscious decision to structure this way and pull that out, is that there's a certain discomfort and distance that I wanted.
It gives Truman's situation a lot of depth, I think, if we get all of that first before we get into his head.
That feels more analysis.
Well, we're talking
than
about craft,
intent.
Right? We're talking about form and function.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh,
right.
Okay.
But craft is the creation. You're doing analysis, which is post hoc. But no, what I wanted was, when I sat down to write this, was I wanted an authorial distance. I wanted the reader to feel a wider distance, a longer distance between the events of the story and everything else. So that doesn't mean that I didn't want them to be privy to characters' thoughts, because the characters' thoughts are central to the thing. But I wanted to have this sense that, and you can also kind of refer to it as kind of the, what do they call it? The, what is it? Editorial omniscience, I think is what they call it. It's where you have this, it's where the implied author is dominant to the whole thing. So where you can be focalizing through one character's sense of perception, but you're aware of the fact that whoever's in control of that can actually see more, and it's
just
letting you in on this thing. It's keeping you at this distance.
It's a little bit more open than that. Yeah.
Yep. And so the structure of this, I could have written, I'm sure there would be, like I said, if I had managed to get any kind of a response from an agent, I'm sure they would want me to take all of the, you know, the artifact parts and the, you know, weird essays on, you know, moon hoaxes and whatever and stuff that are in there out of it and somehow into the narrative arc of these
characters.
That's not what this story is about. What I was trying to do, and the only way I could figure out how to do it without bogging down events that the characters experience, because no matter how disjointed, no matter how disjointed my physical structure is, there's a pretty straight line narrative to all of my fiction. Even though Evolution of Shadows bounces around in time, it's basically Leon.
Yes.
Right. Leon shows up in Sarajevo. You know, they go in search of Gray. They don't find him. They come back to Sarajevo. Boom, he shows up. It's a straight thing, but it's interspersed with them wrestling with, you know, it's been out for 14 years. If anybody who's read it, anybody who is going to read it has probably already read it.
It's definitely, even though it has flashbacks and things like that, it's still linear. It's definitely not episodic. It's not modular for sure.
But if it ever does have that feeling, it does it for a purpose, for a reason. Centering the importance of memory against
the present narrative as a means of
building tension. Well, again, so this was again a kind of a conscious decision. I wanted to maintain this idea of a world funnel throughout the whole thing, that you have this very small story between these characters happening. This dead woman, they were in love with her at one point.
Dealing with grief.
They're wrestling with the impacts of dealing with grief, you know, and I knew I was going to skate right up against the fridging trope.
I'll think about that, but
I don't know if you've read the whole thing yet, but I knew I was going to skate up against the fridging trope.
It didn't occur to me. Oh, really? She's like, oh, yay, dead wife.
My sister mentioned it when she read the first draft, but I think, like I said, if it didn't occur to you, then I probably did a good job of
right now on my Substack,
disconnecting it.
Yeah, no, it did not. That did not occur to me. There's enough emotional complexity and the characters are not. Yeah.
And the case could be made that really their emotional journey begins when the doppelganger shows up, not when Celine dies.
The fridging trope is the thing where the wife is killed, and that is the catalyst that makes the hero do everything from there. But that's, like you just said, that's not at all what's happening here.
But I definitely wanted that. I definitely was using that when I built the first draft, right?
Oh, well, sure.
Same thing that I was using, like, the hooker with the heart of gold.
I mean, tropes are tropes for a reason. People like certain archetypes. You can have a trope. You can have an archetype without it being a trope. In other words, you can have a motif without it being a trope.
And also, you know, there was also this conscious thing is that, you know, I knew that one of the central characters in this novel,
unlike
the Evolution of Shadows, was actually going to be dead. And I couldn't have her, Celine, throughout the course of this story, not have a voice. But it also, because like I said, giving Celine a direct active narrative voice would be the way to get, you know, like the artifact sections and the Blanchard bone and the things about the satellites and everything.
Flashbacks
that would be a way to get
it,
that into the story in a narrative way. Yeah. But what would be the point of that?
Just the descriptions of the artifacts she left behind is very voicey of her. Like, we get a huge picture of who she was through the descriptions of those objects, actually.
Exactly. Of her artwork, of the things that she was interested in, because even, you know, the things she leaves behind, when you get into talking about, you know, the moon hoax or Clyde Tombaugh and his shot out in Discovery of Pluto and his remains being sent out there. Or when I write the sections about the Rising Star Cave.
Right, right.
Celine always gets mentioned somewhere in that. Celine would have been fascinated by this if she were still alive. You know, this was something that always appealed to Celine. And this way, by having those artworks separated out, I could accomplish two things. give Celine her voice. These were the things that interested her, fascinated her, that would have been something that would have made it into her artwork. And then you also get this thing where her artwork reflects kind of what the struggle is that a lot of the characters are going through.
The ring with the gears on it, that whole sequence is like exactly what you're talking about. It's a way that she is, we get this like real deep impact of her. I'm not articulating myself well, but you know what I'm saying? Like what you're just saying just now, that one segment in particular really stands out to me in that way. Like the reason it's a good description of it, so we can really picture it. And the reason she made it for that person and that person's story that they were going through, so we get that person's story too. But yeah, it's necessary to do it that way. I think, I don't think we should need, force everything that you have here onto these two dudes. It's much more important to have it more open.
And I also wanted to have that consciousness of Celine be present, but without being known or at least appearing, because I'm going to actually end up contradicting myself when we get to the end of the story, but actually appearing, at least in the early stages, to be unknown to the men, that, you know, like the story about the globe that opens up and shows, you know.
Yeah, the Argonauts, yeah.
Odysseus and or Jason and the Argonauts or whatever, who it is, sailing by the sirens, right? Or, you know, some of the other things where Celine has done artwork that have to do with masculinity, or even the artwork that she did that has to do with the feminine divine, like the 100 goddess figurines she carved and took photographs in the field. All of that stuff is commenting on this nature of the genders and of time and of love and what constitutes and makes love. And I don't think that I wanted that type of stuff to be close to the surface, because as you all know, as writers, we can lead our audience to water, but we can't make them drink it. To borrow an old cliche, right?
Well, isn't there like a poignant sequence in this sample that we have where her widower like is like, oh, there's these things that her friends know about her that I had no idea. Like, I don't know if I even know her. I thought I knew her, but maybe I just knew one little facet. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, that's what he reaches out to
our sort of parallel protagonist.
Yeah, so consciously, structurally, the reason, and I don't see a lot of writers doing things like this, making conscious decisions like this. When I was talking to my friend earlier this week, it seems almost as if a lot of what's getting published by the big houses is just kind of written on autopilot. This is how a novel is written. You start off with the world funnel. You give us the character's full name in the first paragraph or page or so. You know, you walk us through setting up their world. You can think of it as like a 19th century train ride. You go to the station in your various town. You get on the train, and suddenly the world just slowly unfolds for you at about 45 miles an hour as you go through the countryside. And you may, when you're traveling on this train going forward through the story, occasionally have a flashback because the scenery is so damn boring that you just zone out and think about something else. And that's kind of like the modern novel right now.
Yeah, it's boring.
I don't like it. I'm bored by it. So when it came to like this idea of form and craft and building this particular novel, I wanted to have those images and things that a lot of writers now bury in a narrative. If I had wanted to get the Blanchard bone into this story in the traditional sense, I would have had to have had a character, you know, find it in a book or go to the museum where it is, or be told about it in a flashback by their friend or something like that. I want the Blanchard bone to be important to the narrative. So here it is. Here's what it means. Just boop. And you will find out later that these types of things, like the Blanchard bone and artwork and mythology and space travel, these were all interests of Celine, yes. These are the things that influenced her art and her life and her passions. These were the things that were in her mind that made her glow and,
yeah,
and made
her
be charming
her
in such a way that these two men fell in love
us.
With her. Right. And so in order for the reader to see that without boring them with all these little anecdotal yeah. stories that, well, as they're scattered in these people's memories, just put them in the story. Just
yeah, definitely.
Cut them out. You know, deconstruct the novel in a certain way so that you have this image.
Would you say that this
you
is a modular
artifacts and
form,
what they mean
form,
and how
then?
They relate. I suppose in a way, because I have taken those certain images and things that I want to echo
yeah.
throughout the story out of
the narrative.
The narrative
is,
and just
is linear,
put them
but like
in
what,
the story.
What you've done, exactly
you know,
what you've
in
described,
the middle of something.
That makes it a lot more modal, which I find exciting.
Truman sees the doppelganger. He then goes to an art show where he sees the ex-boyfriend and reaches out to him. They get together. They go. Have you only read the sample part, or did you read?
I've not
any
read
the other...
whole thing, but I've read more than the sample, but it was a long time ago. So basically, they just talk to me as though I've only read the sample.
But that pattern that you see where you have an artifact or historical element, and then you have, you know, a description of some kind of artwork, a thing that Celine did that somehow echoes with what Truman and Justin are going through. That continues throughout the whole novel. And the point is
yeah.
to, you know, following that old cliche about leading a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, is that basically put the water in a very specific container. Right. These are the images and the symbols and the themes, you know,
yes.
the motifs that I want front of mind when you are seeing these two characters interact with each other or with the stripper or with Justin's, you know, estranged girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
you put them in a moon barrel.
Or the stalker. Right.
Right?
So as far as form goes, as conscious, as craft thing, is that it was a very thoughtful process that I went through over a course of years before I sat down and wrote the first draft of like, well, what do I want?
Yes.
How do I want this story to feel? And what is the best means
the
by which
feel?
I
That's
get
a really
that feeling across?
It, yeah.
You know, if I had done just the typical ironweed style of narrative,
it
wouldn't have the feel that I wanted.
Yeah, I think that Truman would have been a lot more pathetic had you done it that way. Instead, we get this very profound sort of sense of isolation. Instead, it's of course he's grieving and he's a sad character, but he's not a pathetic character, if that makes sense, because of how you did that, specifically because of that.
So what's interesting though is that what you find
out, spoiler alert.
I guess I don't actually
believe. I don't care about spoilers
as,
at all.
Yeah, spoiler.
I really don't
believe in spoilers. I mean, if you tell me something that quote unquote spoils a movie or a TV show or a book, then that
Surprise,
means that that
right?
book relied only on that one thing.
If it's well written,
and if
enough,
that's all it relied on,
really interested
it's
to see
a waste
how it
of
gets
my
to that
time.
Point. If I get quote unquote spoiled.
Because there will be so many other things. You know, you might think that one thing is a spoiler, but if the book or the story or the movie is put together well enough, there might
right.
be
oh,
some
that's true too. Yeah,
other thing
yeah.
that would
yeah.
have been the actual spoiler for you, right? This is why way back in graduate school, I made an argument to somebody who's like, fuck that movie Titanic. I don't want to see that piece of crap, you know. Da, da, da.
Yeah, but
I was like, why? Well, you know how it's going to end. Everybody's
going to.
I go, but that's just it. We know the boat's going to sink. That movie was good
right,
because of the emotional arc of the
characters.
And
we knew how it was going to end. That added to the tension, actually.
Right. So, like I said, I don't. If you do your job right as a storyteller, as a creator, you might walk into that book knowing, oh yeah, everybody dies in the end. And then when you get to that moment where they're like dying,
oh my God, I didn't know that.
You're still going,
oh, that's how that happened. Whoa.
Right. Because even with that foreknowledge. Because one thing I've so Ender's Game is a good sci-fi novel, but he was probably the reason he was able to pull off that twist ending. Like it was all,
it was real.
You know, everybody thinks it's, but it wasn't really a game, you know, ending that, right. Is because he builds up, he gets very specific throughout that story to focus on the game aspect of what the kids are learning and plays with that assumption that, oh, you're just dealing with kids. It's not yet serious. And then you get to the end of the book and like, you really weren't playing a game.
Yeah, at the same
you
time, he also weaves a whole thing throughout of these kids aren't really kids. They're really scary advanced, especially this one, which is why the denouement happens the way it does.
And then, of course, after Ender's Game came out, a lot of people tried to do the, but it wasn't really a game type of stories. And they all sucked at it because that was their only twist. They didn't do all the other that Carr did well before he got to that twist.
And after.
And so that's kind of the way I feel about this. So I'm going to, so part of the thing with the Poison Moon, I've always been interested in this idea of the unreliable narrator. Right, because most of the time, they really only apply that to first-person stuff. So what I wanted to do also with all of this was to have this story where you're not quite sure. It feels like, okay, you've got a third-person, omniscient, you know, editorial voice narrator who's up there looking down at everything and knows everything that's going on. But then as you read the story, particularly as you read the sections about artwork and about, you know, the artifacts and things like that, the narrative voice starts to slip a little bit. And then when you get to the end of the book, you realize that this is all being told to you by Justin. And that this is, because what I was always fascinated with was William Maxwell's book, So Long, See You Tomorrow, which is entirely written in the subjunctive mood.
That's on my TBR shelf. I haven't started that one yet.
Because there are two factual events for the narrator of So Long, See You Tomorrow, which is the brief moment where he was playing with his friend in the house that's being constructed, and then the moment where he passed that friend years later in a hallway at a high school and didn't talk to him. Everything else in that novel is speculation, is him going, if dropping into that subjunctive mood.
Interesting.
As a way of generating an apology. And I was like, I want to see if I can pull that off.
Right.
But I didn't want to do that exactly, right? That's just, or just redoing something. And I don't want to do that. So breaking out, deconstructing the world funnel, deconstructing, you know, certain things and breaking that out, getting a very simple narrative in there. And then at the very end, revealing that the whole thing's been told by one of the actors in the story. And that you realize that he could not have known all of this stuff. This is instead an attempt to, having seen something, because that's the thing at the end, he sees an artwork that just makes everything clear to him. And then so everything up to this point is just this story as a means of redemption, of self-redemption.
That's interesting. Yeah, and we get sort of a foreshadowing of that in this sample where he's like, what did you write about me in that journal? He's already starting to sort of give us little hints about that in this very beginning. That's interesting. I want to talk about this parallel. It's the last section in our sample chunk that we have.
Okay, so it's a section in the novel called Artifacts. Odysseus Hears the Sirens. The piece is called Odysseus Hears the Sirens, and it sits in Selene's parents' house in a corner of the living room. It is heavy but looks delicate, and so it rarely moves from where Celine first placed it. An oversized schoolroom globe, approximately 36 inches in diameter, attached to a polished wooden base. The top of the globe opens on a hinge to reveal the delicate model of a Greek trireme on rough seas, made of fired clay painted blue. A tiny figure is tied to the main mast of the trireme. More figures of men are seated at the oars. At one edge of the rough sea are jagged cliffs, and in the cliffs there is an opening to a cave. A small skull sits at the opening. Celine's mother and sister rarely open the globe, and when they do, it is merely to marvel at Celine's skill, her imagination. Her father, when he thinks no one is looking, and Truman, each time he visits, open the globe as if it were a ritual they must perform, as if it contains a mystery they've yet to understand, something deep and resounding about themselves. Perhaps it has to do with the inarticulate moment they realize that each man sails an ocean contained in a singular world not entirely of his own making, and that he's been deposited into a story already in motion, already on a vague and ill-defined course that is, somehow, as rigid as the keel of a ship. He is placed at an oar next to his brother, ears stoppered with wax and made to row, his blind back toward his destination, his eyes watching everything recede away from him so that he only knows where he is once he has left it behind. And the whole time that he rows, neither speaking to nor hearing the effort or pain or excitement of his brother next to him, he believes himself to be the ship's captain. Imagines himself the lonely figure tied to the mast to hear the sirens call while saved from death by the ropes that keep him duty-bound to the ship and the crew. In reality, he is numb to the chain at his ankle, binding him to the bench and the oar, unaware that he cannot be both oarsman and captain. What if the siren's call and a death among the rocks of the siren's island is not the fearful doomed fate men have been made to believe they must stop their ears against? What if the thing they should stop their ears against is the piper's rhythmic demands to row in unison on the hero's boat, aiming for a destination they cannot see and is not of their own choosing, allowing someone else to hear the beautiful song of temptation? And what of Odysseus, choosing to both hear the song and, before knowing its promise or illusion of promise, deciding to remain? What did he think about the rest of his days having heard the siren's call and not been able to answer? For a song to lure men into the wine-dark sea, it must certainly promise something unique to each man. Otherwise, it isn't temptation. Homer wrote that Odysseus recounted the song he heard as this: "Come closer, famous Odysseus, Achaea's pride and glory, moor your ship on our coast so you can hear our song. Never has any sailor passed our shores in his black craft until he has heard the honeyed voice pouring from our lips. And once he hears, to his heart's content sails on a wiser man. We know all the pains the Greeks and Trojans once endured on the spreading plain of Troy when the gods willed it so. All that comes to pass on the fertile earth, we know it all." How could such a song have lured anyone but Odysseus? Or are we to assume that all men born desire only what the man who leads them desires, and only in the same fashion? How could the song Odysseus recounts have tempted him anyway? How could that have implanted the urge to dive overboard, to abandon his sailors, his journey home, his waiting wife? Was Odysseus lying, hiding the true nature of the song? Or was Odysseus blessed to be in conscious harmony with his deepest desire? Did the song of temptation match the song of his own heart so closely that the sirens sang to him exactly what he already knew he desired? Did he strain and fight his bonds only for show, only to keep his sailors pulling, deaf and dumb to the lack of his temptation to veer away? If each man desired unwaveringly to return home as Odysseus did, would any have abandoned ship hearing a song addressed only to Odysseus? Could the sirens have tempted them all with promises of a swifter journey home? Jason navigated the sirens' passage because Orpheus was among his crew, and he played his lyre more beautifully than the sirens could sing, and so his music kept the heroes at their oars, except, it is said, for one. Sharp-eared Butes, unswayed by Orpheus and his lyre, leapt from the Argo at the siren's bidding and surely would have died if not for Aphrodite, who plucked him from the waters and swept him away to be her lover. What did Butes hear? The story doesn't say. What song did the sirens sing to him that would make him focus his attention on that song over the more beautiful one played by Orpheus? It had to have been something he desired more than the promise of fame and treasure made by Jason, because he leapt and was rescued by the goddess of love herself.
Yeah.
Right? So I wanted to be able to do
stuff like
part
that.
Of the reason
yeah,
I built
exactly.
the novel the way I did was so that I could have flights like that.
Yes.
And that's a conscious decision to like abandon certain requirements of traditional structure in the embrace of a certain approach to craft that highlights the ideas
yes.
of a story. Because mm-hmm. Kundera does this a little bit in Unbearable Lightness of Being by, you know, commenting that he's writing a piece of fiction that these characters
are
made
wouldn't
up.
Be, that
and
section wouldn't
exaggerate.
Be, just read, would not be nearly so powerful if it was like a flashback and Selene is reading it to us or something. Like it would not have been, no, like that's just, we just needed that. In that way, in that form, the way it was. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Crafty. You're sailing your craft really well, it sounds like.
Crafty. You know, so the form that the book ended up taking was really about trying to get to those elements that would be buried in a traditional narrative and deconstructing them out and highlighting them so that this very simple narrative could carry a lot more weight than you would think it
would.
The
simple narrative. Right. Exactly.
Making the narrative complicated. Because I like the quiet novel that has something to say about the internal life of people.
Yeah.
I like that more than I like the, you know, adventure! Because if you do the adventure in American it's entertainment, fine. It often involves guns. Yeah. And I'm done with guns. Fuck off with your guns.
No, I know what you're saying, though. It's not,
But yeah, that gets into what I wanted to try and do with those. Wanted you to see that these two male characters, you know, Truman and Justin, if they weren't so bound up in, even though they are not, they're not the stalker. They're not toxic men. They're trying to be good men, but they're still bound up and their behavior determined
and lost
by
and lonely,
our,
and
our
all
social
alone.
Demands of masculinity.
Excellent.
So, yeah. So next month, we're going to talk about your
sample.
Are we
going to do this or do form and function with mine? Okay, sweet.
For form and function.
Sounds good.
Form, functioning
I will
forms.
Pick a good sample for y'all to delve into. I think I know which one I'm going to do. Tune in next month.
I'll see you in a month.
The Outrider podcast is recorded by Jason Quinn Malott and Jen Zuko. Audio is cleaned up and refined by Heather Ann Eden. Our show is hosted by Podbean.com.